KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community station.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 5 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and storytelling right here on KPFT 90.1 Houston Community Radio. Well, we at KPFT are launching one of our fund drives, so we appreciate your support. To help keep us going, you can call us at 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org. There, you can click on donations, then you can scroll down to So What's Your Story to give our show a little support. We do appreciate your contributions because that's what'll keep KPFT's unique programming alive and well. Well, today on So What's Your Story, we're going to feature three fine storytellers, and they will bring us back to their childhoods and share some of the shenanigans that come with growing up. Our guests are Lauren Neamy, Paul Topekian, and Bo Bennett. Well, our first guest today is Lauren Neamy, who's been with us before. Lauren's a longtime storyteller of personal stories and reimagined folktales. Lauren's also a poet and an author of several books on storytelling, including What Haunts Us, which is available on Amazon. Hey, Lauren, welcome back to So What's Your Story?
Thanks. I'm happy to be back.
Hey, Lauren, I was reading about you before the show, and I read that you used to be the ringmaster of a traveling circus. Now, to me, that's like the dream job. What was that all about?
I mean, on the one hand, being this ringmaster of the circus is like God. You keep time and move the world along. On the other hand, it's a terrible responsibility. But let's not even go there. There's so many stories.
we'll save that for another show. Now, tonight's theme, Lauren, is on childhood stories. People have had, you know, kind of interesting childhoods, which from what I know of you, you have. So you've got several stories we're going to hear tonight. Let's hear the first one.
So my childhood was divided pretty much. The first part of it was in Hibbing, Minnesota, where I was born. And the second section was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I went to grade school. So I got a couple of stories from each portion.
Hibbing, Minnesota, where Bob Dylan was from, isn't it?
Yeah, Bobby lived about three blocks away from us. So growing up in Hibbing, on weekends, we would go to my grandmother's farm. That farm was 40 acres of rocks and some hay and six cows. And there wasn't much to look at or much to do, but it had a sauna. Now, if you're Finnish, you know what sauna is. It is the national religion, whether people will admit it or not. And that weekend, every weekend, various families would come out to the farm and they would visit with my grandmother and my grandfather. They would have coffee and they would have rolls in the kitchen. And then one at a time, they would take turns. They would go down to the sauna, take off their clothes, go inside the little inner sanctum where the wood stove was running and the heat was always, easily 120 degrees, right? To sit on the benches and splash the water on. My father would take my brother and myself down to the sauna. Now, I was probably 5 or 6 at the time. I hadn't quite started school. And going to the sauna was always a terrible thing. Not terrible because of the prospect of changing my clothes in a cold outer room or stepping inside the inner room. sit on those cedar benches to have my father take a dipper, a tin dipper of water, well water, and pour it onto the rocks, and the steam rise up and come and set. It sits on your head and it sits in you. It enters your pores and your nose and it fills your lungs, you know. And then my father would wash us with rough lye soap and splash water on us. That was not the terror. The terror was that to get to the sauna, we had to pass the chicken coop. And at the chicken coop, there was a rooster. Now, I tell you, this rooster was evil. This rooster was bad-tempered. This rooster would chase after me, and he would peck at me, and my father would have to shoo him away. The prospect of the sauna was always the prospect of what and where would the rooster be. One day, my father said to me, "You don't have to worry about the rooster anymore." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "The rooster made the mistake of pecking grandma, and she served him for dinner."
So I take it you didn't shed any tears about the demise of that rooster.
Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, you know, I've been to Russia a few times. My wife is Russian. And sauna over there, it's like a religion. But oh, yeah. Like you mentioned, it's like torture. They almost kill each other in there, whip each other with branches. They set the temperature.
That's to get the blood flowing. Yeah. I have a lot of sauna stories, too. But let me tell the other story for the farm, which is that, you know, again, we would go to the farm weekends, and my grandmother never really learned English. She was a fabulous cook, though. She would make these fresh baked rolls with anise and with cinnamon, and there'd always be coffee. One time when we were there in the kitchen, my mother and my father and my grandmother were talking, and my Uncle Uno came. My Uncle Uno lived upstairs in the attic, and he motioned to me to follow him. And so I left the kitchen and went through the living room. I went past the chair that my grandfather used to sit in. No one ever sat in that chair after he died. The Bible he read was sitting open to the place that he had read, was reading it the last time he had. So I followed my uncle up the stairs and up the narrow, narrow stairs to where he lived in the attic. For much of my childhood, I thought my uncle was kind of a gnome, a small man with a curve in the back. But as an adult, I realized it was because he lived in the attic. The only place you could stand upright was in the center of the room. There was a chimney there. There was a dresser there that had a single bottle of Old Spice aftershave on it, which he reserved for weddings and funerals. Along the wall were a series of pegs, and there was his overalls and his shirts. But my Uncle Uno, he goes to that dresser and he reaches in and he pulls out an object, and he says, "Hold out your hand." And so I hold out my hand, and he puts into my hand a small jackknife, a little two-bladed jackknife. And he closes my fingers over that jackknife and he says to me, "No Finnish man is without a knife." And then he says, "Don't tell your mother." But I missed that entirely. I did not hear the "don't tell your mother" part. I was just fascinated by the fact that here I am, 5, 6 years old. My Uncle Uno has given me a knife. And immediately I go downstairs. I run downstairs and go show my mother. And I do. I show it to her and the knife disappears. Just like that. And I'm awestruck. And I turn and I look at my Uncle Uno and he's just shaking his head. And he says, "Come on, we'll go outside and play with the dog." Many years later, the family was sitting around and we were telling stories about the farm. And I told this story to that point. And my mother said, "Wait here." And she got up from the table and I thought, well, maybe I had offended her. I don't know. And off she went. And she came back and she said, "Hold out your hand." And I held out my hand and the knife was back. 30 some years later, my mother says, "You're old enough for this now." My Uncle Uno is dead. He shook himself to death with Parkinson's many, many years ago. My grandmother is dead. She worked the farm until she was 87 and slipped and fell in the barn while milking cows. And the farm got sold. A highway came through and took the land. All of it gone. But I still have that knife. And on some level, it is absolutely true that as long as I have that knife, I have them.
Well, that is quite a story, Lauren. Your mother kept that knife for 30 years, then gave it back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it took you 30 years to develop to the where she would trust you with that little knife.
This story is actually one of the first personal stories I ever told. So we moved to Albuquerque, right? So we moved to Albuquerque, and there's a lot of stories from there, too. But the ones I want to tell today, there's two of them. One of them is, it was the summer of, I don't know, 58, 59. I was in sixth grade. In those days, at least, the boys and the girls still played together. You would have supper, and after supper, through some unknown process, people would all gather at somebody's house. Sometimes at our house, sometimes at Tony Martinez's house, at Tommy Yonkovich's house. I never understood exactly how people knew where to go, but we would gather and we would play various games. We would play variations on baseball. We would play tag. We would play hide and seek. And then there was a period of time where Indian wrestling was the thrill. Now, these days, I think that's sort of a pejorative term, but you know, the game is a simple game. You have two people, they lay down on the ground, their heads in opposite directions, their arms interlocked. They raise the leg that's close to the other party, and the object is to snag your opponent's leg and flip them over. It's a very simple game. And depending on how well matched you are, it can be a lot of fun. So we were at Tony Martinez's house, and boys and girls all standing around, and people started to play. And Tony and Tommy Yonkovich went down to the ground. And I got to say, Tommy was probably 20 pounds heavier and 6 inches taller than Tony. And bam, just like that, Tony went tumbling off. And Tommy would have been done with it. But Tony runs back and he jumps down again. He says, again, I can do you. I can get you. And they try a second time. They try a third time. Every time, Tommy just sends him tumbling. And Tony's getting angrier and angrier. And there's this moment where all of a sudden, Lucy says, give it up, Tony. You can't win. And he turns to her and he looks at her. Now, Lucy is this tall, thin beanstalk of a girl. And she says, even I can take you. And everyone went, and she lay down on the ground. And Tony lay down on the ground next to her. And their legs went up. And for Lucy, when her leg went up, she was wearing not slacks or blue jeans. She was wearing a sundress. And her dress fell down. And you could see her white cotton panties. And no one quite knew how to respond to that. But she caught his leg. And she flipped him. And he jumped up and he ran back and he said again. And she said, no. But she didn't get up. And he jumped on top of her. He jumped on top of her to say, you will do this. I can beat you. And she just laughed and grabbed his head. And as she brought it down, she gave him just a little kiss on the cheek and started to push him away. When at that very moment, from the door of the house comes his father. He comes rushing out and he's got a rolled up newspaper in one hand. He grabs Tony and he jerks him off of Lucy and he sort of bats him with the newspaper and drives him into the house. And everyone in that yard is standing around trying to figure out what happened. That was the last time the boys and the girls played together.
Wow.
You know, it's like all of these kids on the cusp of hormones, not knowing what to do or not knowing how to respond, you know, which actually leads to my second story. I've been actually going back to Albuquerque a number of times over the last 5 or so years. And I've gone past the old house a number of times. When the first couple of times I went past it, it seemed to have been abandoned. And it was very, very sad for me to see this house sort of looking forlorn. And then somewhere along the line, someone got it and they started to remodel it. And so now when I drive past it, it doesn't look like the old house anymore. It's just weird. But even stranger is that next to the house, as a child, there was a big vacant lot where we would play baseball. And now in the, where was that vacant lot, there are two houses which both look like something out of a sci-fi novel. They're high, vertical, ultra-modern houses with curves and color, and it's just like, wow, what is that? But behind those modern houses and behind the house that's been remodeled is the alley. And the alley was the kingdom of the boys. This may also be the case in Houston in some of the older neighborhoods, or that the houses have walled backyards. So if you were in the alley, what you saw was this long, narrow strip of dirt, and on each side walls and the back ends of various casitas, and they were uneven. But if you were brave or foolhardy, you could climb up on a wall, and you could run along the top of the wall, or you could run across, jump from space to space. You could jump over gates, and you had to avoid the Sanchez's on the far side, because he had dogs, man. He had big dogs. And if you fell into that yard, you were in trouble. But one of the games was chase, you know, and you'd chase along the stretch of the alley. You'd chase along the tops, you know. It was all about up and down and back and forth. Or we would build ramps out of old boards on top of concrete bricks. And we would run bicycles up over the ramps, you know, Evel Knievel style, before Evel Knievel was even a thought. That kingdom, the kingdom of boys, was a separate world. Mm-hmm. It was the world where rumor and learning what it meant to be a man was sort of discussed, you know. Mm-hmm. People would, you know, oh, I'm going to grow up and be a fireman. Oh, I'm going to grow up and join the military. Oh, I'm going to grow up. No one ever said, I'm going to grow up and work in an office. That was, you know, I'm going to play football. I'm going to play baseball. You know, everything that you wanted to do as a child in terms of the future was something which was active, something which in which you had a chance to express, you know, your greatest gifts. So this one particular time I'm thinking about, In the alleys, we were going along, and all of a sudden, the back gate to one of the houses opens up. But there's no one standing there. Hmm. And all the boys, we all cluster around the door, and we're trying to figure out why the gate opened. Who's there? And this was a house that nobody knew anything about. We didn't know who lived there. We never saw anybody. Even if you looked in the garbage can, a lot of the times there was nothing in the garbage cans. Again, this is another story where Tony Martinez comes into play. He says, I'm going to go inside. And so he steps into the yard, and he's wandering around the yard going, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. When all of a sudden the gate closes.
Wow.
Without an explanation.
Oof.
But not only closes, we're trying to open it and it doesn't open again. And he is now trapped in the yard. And all people can say is, Tony, get out of there. And the question becomes, how?
Hmm.
How? And he's jumping up trying to grab the top of the wall, and he's not quite making it. And so what happens is we go, okay, we're going to do the old geometric progression. We don't actually call it that, but we say, we're going to stand on each other, right? And so we have three guys on the bottom, you know, the ones who are most capable of bearing weight, and then two guys on top of them, and then someone who is relatively light and who is relatively strong gets up on top and leans over the wall with his arms down so that when Tony leaps up, they can grab their arms and we can haul him back over on the other side. And we did. But to this day, I've thought, every time I've ever thought about that moment, I've wondered, why did that gate open?
Huh.
Why did that gate close? But it did serve one purpose. And that purpose was, is it reminded us boys that for all of the competition we had, for all of the razzing, for all of the insults, for all of the jokes, for all of the pranks, when it came down to it, we were willing to stand up and reach out to retrieve our own.
Ah, yeah, I love that. So that's like an eternal mystery now. What opened that door? What was
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was a great story, Lauren. I could listen to your stories all day, but we got time constraints here. But before we let you go, are there any projects in the works that you'd like to let us know about?
Well, it's interesting because these days with COVID being what it is, most of the teaching I'm doing is online. And in support of that, I've actually created what is known as what we're calling the American School of Storytelling. So look at, if you Google American School of Storytelling, it should come up. So right now I'm offering a special on coaching for small groups and pairs.
Yeah. That sounds like a great site.
All right.
Well, thanks again, Lauren, for all your stories, and hope you can be back again someday.
All right. Thanks. I appreciate it. Have fun.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Eric Keene, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, and 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And here's what is happening in the storytelling world in the Houston area. Everyone is welcome to join the Houston Storytellers Guild. They hold a virtual story swap the fourth Tuesday of every month, and they feature storytelling workshops and similar events. And on April 30th, they're going to hold their annual Liars Contest. And you can visit our program on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, and it's called So What's Your Story? The Moth at Warehouse Live is back to featuring live performances the second Tuesday of every month. Their next swap will be February 8th at the Warehouse Live. Well, KPFT has launched their fund drive, so we're asking you to help keep us going strong. Because where else can you hear such eclectic, progressive, and multicultural programming? KPFT includes everybody. And you can help make all this happen by calling 713-526-5738. And that's also 713-JAM-KPFT, 713-526-5738. Or you can go to kpft.org and click on the donation button, and then you can scroll down to our program, So What's Your Story, to designate us for your support. So thank you for helping make all this happen at KPFT, Houston Community Radio. Well, our next guest is well known to our listeners. He's been on our program numerous times because we love his stories. He is Paul Topekian. Paul is from Yonkers, New York, but he's lived in Houston for about 30 years. He's been a cab driver, shipping clerk, pool builder, and global retail service manager for ExxonMobil. And he's a volunteer at the Moth Storytelling Organization, where he frequently tells his own stories. Now, on top of all this, Paul is a proud husband, parent, and grandfather. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Eric. It's been challenging times, but we're making through it okay.
Good to hear. Paul, when the theme for tonight's show materialized, which is mischievous childhoods, for some reason, you immediately came to mind, because I've noticed that over the years, quite a few of your stories at the Moth and here on our program have dealt with some pretty adventurous times in your childhood. And from these stories, I sense that you might have been sort of a mischief maker as a kid. Would you say that's an accurate assessment?
I would say that was a very accurate assessment. I had a younger brother and very good friend, Reggie. My younger brother's Bruce. And the three of us together, we did a lot of stuff that got us in trouble with our parents.
Well, your first story here today is about you and some friends at a golf course. Let's hear that story.
Well, back in Yonkers, where I grew up, there were two traditional events that sort of marked the official start of summer. One was a long-standing tradition in the neighborhood that had been passed down from group of kids to the next group of kids. And it had to do with the start of weekday play at St. Andrew's Golf Course, which was right behind our housing development, separated by some woods. It always happened the first week after school was out in Yonkers. So this was usually close to the 4th of July, middle of June. This opening required tremendous planning. The course had to be walked. The equipment needed to be procured. Our uniforms needed to be arranged and ready. And most importantly, we needed to really understand the paths onto and off of the golf course. So we'd go out and survey it and confirm it and make sure we were good. And we would do a dry run on Monday, and then we'd be ready for what you would call, I guess, the hard opening on Tuesday. Tuesday morning at about 8:45, the first flight of golfers would be making their second shot to the sixth green. This was way before golf courts. So golfers would shoot. They didn't have caddies at St. Andrews. They carried their clubs or they rolled them. So we would have to wait for the golfers to approach as they came down the fairway. When they were close, but not too close, that's when we yelled charge. And out of the woods would come 5, 10, 15 kids, all dressed in camouflage, carrying bazookas, rifles, sticks, whatever we had. And the idea was not to steal the golfers' balls per se. Well, that's what we would do. The idea was to get the balls with the golfers close enough that you would actually get the golfer to follow you into the woods. Now, this had to be done with pretty close to military precision, because the goal was to get the golfer into the woods, but to not get caught. What we had to help us with this were four obstacles as we went through these woods. And to give you the sense, these woods were probably about 100 yards deep, and they ran the entire length of the golf course. And so they wound downhill towards where our houses were. The first obstacle was a stone wall. The second one was called Frankie's Grave. There was this longstanding belief in our neighborhood that Frankenstein and his wife had been buried on the edge of the golf course. There actually were these two big rock cisterns, but they were Frankie's grave. There was a big drop off behind this tree, and you needed to know it was there, and you needed to know how to get around it. There was a piece of vine that came down, and if you hooked it right, you could actually kind of run full speed at this tree and pass on behind it. And if you were a golfer, didn't know how to do it, you would just run full speed right off the path. And at the very bottom, there was a hole in the fence, and that hole was big enough for kids, but not big enough for golfers. We were ready to go, and there were only really, on this day, two flaws in our plan. One was that Mark Griswold, who was with us that day, had open heart surgery. And this was actually the first day that Mark was allowed out of his house, and we were very excited to have him with us. The second flaw was that there was a golfer who must have run track in college, because he was exceedingly quick. So we had grabbed these balls and we were running to the woods, two golfers behind us, Mark running slower than the rest of us. We tore down the path, we navigated through the stone wall. And if the golfer didn't know how to get through it, it would be like running through 20 feet of woods and then all of a sudden running into a mound of rocks that's hard to get over. Well, we slipped through it. The golfer that was behind us kept going. He got stopped at Frankie's grave. Frankie's grave, those two holes were sort of set like a figure eight. And there was a tiny 1 foot path that was between them. And if you knew where it was, you were golden. And if you didn't know where it was, well, you ended up in the hole. And that's what happened with one golfer. We made our way down the path, past the tree, now through the holes. And then we heard this noise, and it was kind of scary. We weren't sure what was going on. We couldn't go back in because we didn't know where that golfer that had chased us was. He might have given up or he might have been lurking. But we listened. And what we found had happened was that Mark had just somehow completely missed the path and decided that instead of following the path, he was just going to go straight down through the woods to the hole. Well, the problem with that, if you've ever run through woods, is you really can't run straight through woods because there's trees in the way. There's little trees in the way. There's brushes in the way. And what ended up happening was Mark and this golfer who must have run track both came down the hill super fast, more falling than running. And ultimately, they made the cut. The golfer almost got Mark, but he made it through the hole, and it was quite fun standing there, the golfer quite mad at us, unable to come over the fence, and us just sort of walking away down into the neighborhood with two golf balls. So we went back down to Reggie's house. probably a couple of three blocks away, to go through what had happened and really to try and understand what had happened with Mark. And we digested everything and understood what had gone wrong. He was extremely winded and didn't sound very good. But nonetheless, we had had quite fun. A little bit later, the bell rings. We have to go back for dinner. And Mark, I don't know why he did this, but rather than going through the gate, he decided he was going to hop over it. And he hopped and he got his shoelaces twisted and he came down on his arm. Because the second thing that was the indication that summer was here was that Mark would break his arm. And he would break his arm for 5 summers in a row. But never would he break his arm on the same day that we did the golf balls. And with that, we knew this was going to be one hell of a summer. With 4th of July coming, it was time for us to get on. You know, we needed to start collecting bottles for deposit, and we needed to start returning shopping carts to the AMP so we'd have fireworks for the 4th.
Hmm. So did that end this scheme, or did you keep?
We couldn't. It didn't end it. We would do this every summer. When it opened, and this little thing actually got handed down from the older kids in the neighborhood to us. Uh-huh. And then we'd hand it down to the younger kids.
Well, Paul, your next story I heard when you told it, The Moth, and it had the audience just rolling on the floor with laughter. It's about an incident when you and a friend were digging a foundation in your backyard when you were 13. Let's hear that story.
So my father was a big believer in learning by doing, and he was also a big believer in work. He just thought doing work was good. And he hired Reggie, my friend and I, to dig this hole. And when he did that, he made 2 proclamations at the very beginning of the job. One was that this was dirt that no one had ever dug in. It was virgin earth. Who knows what we would find? And the second one was that we would not hit any big rocks. Well, my father was wrong on both counts. We hit Ballantine beer cans that were rusted down about 2 feet. And we ultimately unearthed a rock that was about the size of a bathtub. We pleaded with my dad at that point to get us a jackhammer because we really thought, you know, that's what you do. You jackhammer things. When you've got a rock like that, you jackhammer it. And my dad did not want to do that because he did not believe we would be capable of it. He insisted that we use regular tools. Use a pick, use a chisel, use a hammer, you know, go at it. You can break this rock. And so that's what we did. We started chiseling it. We started hammering it. The pick didn't work very well because it would just bounce off. The chisel with a little 2-pound hammer, you could get little pieces of rock to come off, but we would have been chipping all day, or really chipping all summer. So what we tried was one person swinging a sledgehammer and another person holding the chisel. And that turned out to be a little bit scary because neither one of us could really aim the sledgehammer very well. And so the person that was holding the chisel had to be prepared should the blow look like it was going the wrong direction. Self-preservation, we decided not to do that. We did try using a stick to hold the chisel, but we found out if you hit the chisel solidly, it would just go flying someplace and it might fly into us. So no more chisels, no more hammers, no more picks. Being 13 years old, we went for what would make the most sense to do next. We amassed fireworks, M80s, packed them around the base of the rock, and tried to explode it. That didn't work. Then we thought, okay, what else can we do? We'd both been big fans of Mr. Wizard, which was a science show. And one of the things that he had been talking about recently was thermodynamics and how if you can heat things up and chew them down, things will crack. And so we thought, this is a good possibility for us. So we started with what was the simplest thing to do. We started boiling water in the kitchen, running outside and dumping the water on the rock. We did this for 6 hours, starting at 8 a.m. And at about 2:30 in the afternoon, we decided we had gotten the rock as hot as we were going to get it. We got the garden hose out and blasted it, and nothing happened. No chip, no nothing, just a very wet hole. But we still thought this heat thing could work. And so what we decided to do was see if we could find something that would make heat faster. And we did. We found lighter fluid in the little shed in the backyard and took that out and poured that on the rock and lit it on fire. And that actually seemed to be doing something. It seemed like it was actually creating a flame and maybe some heat. But ultimately, the problem there was we only had a quart of lighter fluid, and it burned away pretty quickly. And so it was, you know, lighter fluid is expensive. What can we get to use that it doesn't cost as much? And, you know, back in the day, you go with the cheapest flammable thing you can get, which is gasoline. And so we went and got 2 gallons of gasoline. And we had learned from when we were doing the lighter fluid that you really didn't want to be standing down in the hole when you set the rock on fire. So what we rigged up was a pipe that we could pour the gasoline down, and it would go over the rock and then get it nice and soaked. And then this was something that we had picked up from the movies. We had seen that you could actually light gas from a distance away. So not only did we deliver the gas down through the pipe, but when we lit the gas, we lit it by just lighting a match at the end of the pipe. The problem with all of this is that stuff that you watch in the movies and stuff that you do in your backyard, actually, they're not the same at all. The match, as soon as it came close to the pipe, there was this huge whoosh sound, and the whole rock went up, the hole went up. There's this big cloud of black stuff that's going up into the air. And I was watching it, and I remember thinking, well, this is really, this might work. This is really hot. And then I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, it's really hot. It's like turning the siding on the back of the house brown. And then it was like, oh my God, I'm burning the house down. And so I grabbed the hose and I sprayed the rock with the hose. And I don't know if any of you have had any experience with gasoline and trying to put it out with water, but basically all I did was just push burning gasoline all the way around the inside of this hole. Luckily, gas burned itself out and didn't actually set the house on fire. And unfortunately, it didn't break the rock. Reggie and I were both kind of staring at the situation and wondering if we could somehow make it so that my dad didn't notice. But there were three big problems. One was there was this smell of burning, of burnt gas. And there was this huge black soot mark on the side of the house, which we tried to wipe off, but were unsuccessful. And the third was Mrs. Chufo, who was standing over in the next yard when we lit it. And she was clearly distressed and told my parents what had happened. My father at that point relented and realized that maybe he had given us too much of a challenge and that maybe he should get us the right tool. And so he went ahead and arranged to get a jackhammer. The jackhammer was a 60-pound electric jackhammer. It weighed a little bit less than Reggie or I. And when we would stand on the rock with the jackhammer and start to hammer, what would happen is we would just bounce right off the rock. Neither one of us was strong enough to be able to stay on it and jackhammer. And we decided that the best way to resolve that was, you know, again, being somewhat inventive, there was a swing set in the neighborhood that we were pretty certain wasn't being used. And so we went and asked if we could borrow it, brought it over, and we sat it over the rock like a gantry crane, and we tied the jackhammer to the swing set. And that way we could stand on the rock, hold on to the jackhammer, and jackhammer like we were tail gunners in a fighter plane. And the good news was that with that arranged, we were able to destroy that rock. And that was one of the truly proudest days of my life.
I got to admire your persistence in that.
We were having fun. I mean, one of the things that I think was wonderful about my dad and I think, Reggie grew up in a similar situation. We had parents who were both very much, go out and do stuff. You're going to learn by doing things. And, they gave us leeway to do sometimes too crazy stuff. But I really think it was for me, one of the best things I can ever think of in terms of a gift from parents is giving you the opportunity to go out and do stuff and learn.
Right. Well, that's why you got so many good stories, I would venture to say. Paul, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, now you're a volunteer for the Moth, the storytelling organization. So what's with the Moth these days? Are they back to live performances?
Yeah, the Moth is back, and we're at Warehouse Live, generally the second Tuesday of the month. The theme for February, which is going to be coming up pretty quickly, is Love Hurts, which is usually a great night to come. Tickets are $15. The show opens at 7 and the stories start at 7:30. I'd encourage everybody to come out. It's probably the best $15 entertainment you're going to get in Houston.
Well, Paul, thank you for your stories. It's always good to have you here on So What's Your Story?
My pleasure. Eric, it's great to be back with you, and I hope to see you soon in real life.
Definitely. Take care, my friend.
Ciao.
Well, now we'll hear from Bo Bennett. Bo was born and raised in Connecticut. He got a PhD in social psychology, and lately, Bo has been writing books and screenplays, and Bo also runs a company called ebookit.com. You can read all about what he does at his website, bobennett.com. Bo, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
Now, I've been reading your book, Bo, and it's very entertaining, and it is fictionalized, but are all these stories, are they basically based on a true story?
Yes. In fact, they are pretty much as true can get. However, of course, when you're telling a story that took place when you were 10 and you're now 50, there's going to be some elements in there that didn't quite happen exactly that way. I feel like all, even autobiographies are fictionalized to a point. People just don't like to admit that. So really, the heart of everything that you're going to hear today and everything in my book is true.
Sure. Yeah, and I agree with you. Very few, if any, stories are 100% nonfiction.
That's right.
So now, these stories, from reading them, they could stand on their own. But is there an overriding message you're trying to convey throughout the book?
I think so. I think there might be a few different messages. You probably heard before the saying that comedy is tragedy plus time. And I think if there was a core message here, that's probably it. Everybody's life story contains quite a bit of tragedy. Mm-hmm. The thing about our family, in our family, tragedy becomes comedy after like a day. We don't wait very long. And I think that's something that I really liked about our family. We don't take things too seriously. Even though somebody from the outside might be looking at our family and saying, wow, you know, these people are messed up. These people got problems. Yeah. And in the scheme of things, we may have. But again, it's the way that we see it and we looked at it, which really made our lives more enjoyable.
It's a good way to look at it. Okay, yeah. Well, why don't we hear one of these stories? Your first story is called Toxic Scripts.
Yeah, Toxic Scripts. So it was a typical evening in the Murphy household. The year was 1978. My father, Fred, a heavyset man with dyed jet black greased back hair, was sitting at the kitchen table wearing one of his three outfits. This one was khaki colored pants and a matching button down shirt, purchased at Sears for $19.95. With his Seagram 7 and club soda in one hand and a burning cigarette in the other, Fred pretended to be paying attention to the evening news while my mother, Dolores, proceeded with one of her alcohol-induced rants. Look at you, goddamn good-for-nothing lousy drunk, sitting there getting drunk, cigarette ashes all over the place, food stuck in your mustache. Is that even from tonight's dinner? Dolores, my mom, had one light gray cotton robe that she wore nightly and accessorized with curlers and a bottle of wine. She sat next to Fred, my dad, holding a large, filled-to-the-brim wine glass in her left hand, and in her right hand was a lit cigarette with ashes that always seemed to be on the verge of falling. I walked into the kitchen sporting a Star Wars onesie, the kind with the booties that generate enough electricity to knock a 5-year-old on his ass each time he touches a light switch. I pleaded in desperation, "Will you please stop fighting?" The day of my birth, February 16th, 1972, is one of infamy rather than celebration. When my parents were engaged in their nightly ritual of drinking and mutual verbal sparring, and I stepped in with my feeble attempt to make the peace, but inevitably bring up the events that may or may not have transpired on this historic day. "Why don't you ask your father where he was in the hospital when I was giving birth to you?" rhetorically asked Dolores with a noticeable drunken slur. Already having heard this story many, many times, I rolled my eyes. With an equally drunken slur, Fred responded to the question that I didn't bother to ask. "I was out celebrating because my son was born on my birthday." Fred looked at me and gave me a wink. Fred had a knack for getting his kids to side with him, not through logic or reason, but through winks, dad jokes, and sometimes $10 bills. My dad and I share the same birthday along with Ice-T, Sonny Bono, John McEnroe, and Kim Jong-il. Perhaps at an unconscious level, the cosmic connection is another reason I tended to side with my father over my mother. Dolores had a different theory regarding Fred's whereabouts the day I was born. "You goddamn liar. You were at the bar getting drunk like you always do and screwing around with your whores." Fred and Dolores had this kind of relationship where infidelity on both of their parts wouldn't be much a surprise to anyone who knew them. But the reference to Fred's whores was more figurative than literal. According to the implied criteria set forth by Dolores, to qualify as a whore, one had to be female, between the ages of 17 and 60, and come within a 10-foot radius of Fred. Dolores made exceptions for immediate family members, close friends of her children, and herself. This conversation or script, rarely modified, played out over and over again like poorly written computer code stuck in an endless loop. The repetitiveness was most likely due to the fact that both Fred and Dolores would get so drunk that they simply didn't remember what they had and had not argued about the night before. This script was just one of their many that I heard night after night. The others all revolved around the themes of jealousy, infidelity, intoxication, and hatred. To say that I grew up in a toxic environment would be an understatement. I gave my mom my full support when she would sit me down and tell me that she and my father were getting a divorce. This script played out at least three times per year. I needed my father and mother. I just didn't need or want them under the same roof. Fred and Dolores never did get a divorce. There were probably many reasons that despite their contempt for one another, they stayed together, including their children, finances, and the stigma attached to divorce given their Catholic upbringing. Perhaps the biggest reason was that they needed each other in a highly codependent and psychologically unhealthy way. The next morning, Fred and Dolores sat in the same chairs at the kitchen table as the night before, dressed in their day clothes, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. Fred watched the news on television while Dolores read about how vampires were taking over the White House in her favorite paper, the Weekly World News. "Did you hear what that son of a bitch mayor said?" Dolores asked while half listening to the television. "Yeah, he's a goddamn idiot." Both Dolores and Fred would often find pleasure and camaraderie in their mutual hate for their common enemies, be it a relative, a family friend, or a politician. Even the good times were based on anger and hate.
Wow. Well, that first chapter, that really sets the mood for the rest of the book there, doesn't it?
You would think so. You would think from that chapter, the rest of the book is all going to be pretty depressing, but it kind of takes a turn. But in order to really appreciate the other stories, you have to have a good sense of who my parents were.
Were you really on a first name basis with your parents?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, with that all set up, let's hear another story. And this one has something to do with space aliens.
That's right. And this is definitely more lighthearted. It basically is more like the other stories in the book. So I'll tell this. And this was, again, a completely true story as far as I can remember it. So I call this one Close Encounters of the Non-Existent Kind. So Dolores, my mom, was a wonderfully interesting person with a passion for the fantastical, magical, and mystical. Her favorite books included the 33-volume set of the Time Life series, Mysteries of the Unknown, which she called The Government is Covering Up. One of her favorite shows I used to watch with her was the 1977 through 1982 TV series In Search Of. The weekly broadcast devoted to topics such as body-snatching aliens, monsters, magic, witchcraft, finding Bigfoot, finding Atlantis, and other mysteries, ironically hosted by Leonard Nimoy, who is best known for playing Spock, the personification of logic. The only movie I ever remember watching with my mom in the movie theater was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The perfect movie to take a five-year-old who wants to spend the next 20 years of his life sleeping with the lights on. Being born and raised in this alternative reality of alien abductions, healing crystals, and psychic powers had its pros and cons. Although I wasted countless hours trying to move things with my mind, this desire to get in touch with my psychic side did teach me the lesson of persistence. Like Edison, who chalked up his failures to just another successful confirmation that one way did not work, I figured I had successfully experimented with hundreds of objects that I could definitely not move with my mind. But back to the story. It was a spring evening in 1978. Annie, my sister, and I were headed back from Lordship Roller Skating Rink, located on Long Island Sound in Stratford, Connecticut, where we were discoing it up to Donna Summer, Blondie, and the Bee Gees. Dolores was piloting the family station wagon when a light in the sky caught her attention. "Dear Jesus! What is it?" asked Annie. Dolores hysterically responded, "It's an alien spaceship. They're flying over the hospital healing sick people." My mom, Dolores, believed she had ascertained all of this by a glance through the nicotine-covered windshield. She began driving recklessly through the traffic with her head out the window. "Take me! Take me!" Annie and I were both staring at Dolores with wide eyes, unsure what was going on exactly. "Kids, I want you to know that I love you both very much. I'm going to go for a ride with the aliens in their ship. I'm not sure when or if I'm coming back, but I don't want you to worry about me, okay?" I ducked on the floor in the back seat and started crying. "Mom, will you please slow down? You're going to get us killed," yelled Annie. "Just shut up. Shut up and pay attention." Dolores proceeded to give Annie, who was 14 years old at the time, a crash course on how to drive the car back home, implying that she would be unable to fulfill that monthly responsibility of taking her children home if she were cruising the universe with her new intergalactic friends. The distraction of having to give Annie the impromptu driving lesson resulted in the spaceship getting away from Dolores, which led to Dolores driving faster, Annie yelling louder, and me crying harder. 10 minutes later, there was complete silence in the car. We were parked on the side of the road. I was sitting tall in my seat. Annie was staring at Dolores. Dolores was looking forward with both hands on the steering wheel. The cop that pulled Dolores over returned and handed Dolores a ticket. Dolores grabbed the ticket and said under her breath, "I know what I saw." "Uh-huh," the cop responded. Dolores didn't make first contact with an intelligent alien race that night. She didn't correctly distinguish one of the very many common earthly flying objects from an intergalactic star cruiser. And she didn't give me confidence that aliens probably wouldn't take me from my room at night. She did, however, successfully demonstrate that yelling at a flashing light on the sky while chasing it in a car would result in a hefty fine for reckless driving and a field sobriety test.
Well, Bo, I can see how your mother's belief in the supernatural would make for an interesting childhood.
Oh, my goodness. And that's one of literally hundreds of stories that didn't make it into the book.
You think your mother actually believed aliens were coming down?
I think she did. I think she did. I think it's not only about aliens coming down. It's about aliens coming down and taking over the White House. And you have to just take the somewhat plausible idea of another race of being somewhere in this vast universe, and then combine it with all these crazy ideas you would read in the World Weekly News. And that's what my mom did. And she believed it to that extent.
Right. Yeah. Well, Bo, I enjoyed all of your stories today. And I understand this book, A Mostly Magnificent Memoir, that actually started out as a screenplay. Is that in the works of being filmed?
It's not currently being filmed. I submitted it to a bunch of contests, industry contests, and it did win a finalist in the Big Apple Film Festival, which is a big one. So I was really proud of that. And it did win some awards in other contests. So hopefully that will give it the recognition it needs. And I wanted to put it out in book format as well and audiobook format. If you like my, or if your listeners like my storytelling, I narrated the stories throughout my book as well. So you can get it on audiobook, Audible, and anywhere audiobooks are sold.
Right. And it's available on Amazon?
Yes. All the major bookstores, wherever you can get books online.
Okay. Great. Okay. And the book is called A Mostly Magnificent Memoir. And you have a website called BoBennett.com. All right, Bo. Well, it's been great having you on, and good luck in all your ventures there.
Thank you so much. It's been fantastic telling these stories and sharing them with you and your audience. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Bye-bye. Well, that's our show for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed our guests, Lauren Neamey, Paul Topekian, and Bo Bennett. And don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower is up next with R&B Gold. It's a cool mix of soul music. And may KPFT 90.1, Houston Community Radio, a part of your everyday life. And support us. You will enjoy our programming even more if you contribute by calling 713-526-5738 or by going to kpft.org, and there you go to donations. And you can scroll down to So What's Your Story to designate as the program you support. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. When I'm lying in my bitterness, I don't want to grow. Nothing ever seems to turn around.
What's happening, KPFTers? This is Jeff Plankenhorn. From my years of traveling the road with Texas artists, backing them up, to my rise to solo artist recording and touring all over this wonderful world of ours, I know just how important public radio is, and real DJs who have the freedom to play the music of independent artists like me, and my friends, mentors, and musical cohorts, curated specifically for their listeners. KPFT is undoubtedly one of those very special stations. That's why I am hoping you'll support KPFT with your donation in any amount. Call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Help keep independent radio on the air and going strong on KPFT Houston.
This is Quantum Leap Radio. I am the grandfather clock.
And I am your girl, Dope Courtney, a.k.a. Dopico Jones. And we are excited.
No.
Oh, wait. I said it, didn't I? I'm sorry. This is your girl, Dope A. Courtney, a.k.a. Dopico Jones.
I want to tell the people that we are now in their ear on a Saturday.
Our new time is 9 a.m. to 11 a.m.
That's right, where they can get the hip-hop of the past, present, and possibly future.
You want to find us on the HD2 channel at 9 a.m.
KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, HD.2, or worldwide at kpft.org/listen under the HD2 link, or you can actually find us on the Pacifica Radio app. This is Houston's community station. We are Quantum Leap Radio.
You're listening to